Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Chun with Medical Monday. The COVID-19 pandemic has forced many of those working in the medical profession to take stock of our lives and reflect on how our calling to help alleviate suffering has been deeply challenged in this difficult time. My guest today has written a memoir about his life and career as a psychiatrist who developed a specialty caring for other doctors and professional students as they struggled with mental health challenges, mistreatment, relationship issues, and throughout the 80s and 90s, another pandemic, HIV and AIDS. Michael Myers is professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He's the author of 9 books, including his new memoir titled Becoming a Doctor's Doctor. Myers has been in practice for 4 decades, forming his professional identity in the tumultuous 1960s in both Southern California and then back in his native Canada. Raised in a conservative Catholic family, Myers eventually married and converted to his wife's Judaism, which further informed his professional and personal journeys. Myers realized he was gay in his early 20s, but chose to suppress that part of his identity until his children were grown. He amicably split from his wife and moved to New York, where he has taught and practiced medicine, continuing in his role helping professionals cope with mental illness, substance use, and relationship struggles. In addition, he serves on the admissions committee at SUNY Downstate Medical School, where he is also the ombudsman for student affairs, meaning that one of his jobs is to investigate and explore allegations of student mistreatment on campus. Like many of us, Dr. Myers has been doing nearly all of his work remotely for the last 10 months, but heartened by the enthusiasm that students and trainees have shown in wanting to work on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Michael Myers, author of the new memoir, Becoming a Doctor's Doctor, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Michael Myers, welcome back to Medical Monday. Congratulations on your new memoir, Becoming a Doctor's Doctor. You talk about how you chose your professional pathway, and it wasn't a straight path. But particularly, you write with good humor about your very first interview in psychiatry as a medical student, where you were sort of thrown into the deep end and interviewed a patient who was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and believed every word she said. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I will. John, thank you so much, by the way, for having me on your program. I really appreciate it. Yes, that was quite an experience. As I mentioned in the book, I was asked, the way this professor worked is that he just threw us in the deep end. He wanted us to just, you know, spend time speaking with people, and then we would meet with him and just report what we found. And anyway, this was a university student, so she was very bright and very delusional, but I didn't know what a delusion was in those days. And I just believed everything that she said. But as I also mentioned in the book, what was so lovely is that the professor, first of all, he then went and interviewed her, and her psychosis and all of her suffering just, you know, came out in Technicolor. But he was so professional in his approach to me about that. And I think that must have meant something to me in some ways, that even though I kind of blew it with regard to this, maybe there's something about this field that would have some appeal to me. But as you know from reading the book, it was still sometime later that I actually decided to pursue psychiatry. So,
yeah, well, and another formative experience that you had, I think, was even earlier than that. It was your first year as a medical student, and it was very haunting where you went home for, I guess, what was Canadian Thanksgiving in an October weekend and came back to find out that one of your 3 other roommates had committed suicide.
Yes, that was very, very difficult. Bill, his pseudonym of his first name, I was the last person to see him alive before the weekend, and then I'll never forget my landlady, you know, sitting down with me and telling me about his death by suicide. I can still kind of remember the physiological feeling, just felt like sort of kicked in the gut or something like that, and a little bit woozy, that sort of thing. But, you know, I had the news, and then I tried to talk with my 2 roommates. Well, one of them was overseas. The other, though, had a big exam, didn't seem to be even that interested. The next day, though, I'll never forget, because I stood in front of my class and told them that Bill had died by suicide over the holiday weekend. I can still remember my voice catching and my wobbly knees and the look on my classmates' faces, even though this is 1962. So it's a long time ago, but it was a pivotal experience. Suicide was handled unbelievably poorly back in those days, so stigmatized. I thought so much about Bill's death. If he had been killed in a motor vehicle accident, we would have had a proper send-off, and we would have gone to his funeral, sent some flowers, sent a card. We did nothing. It was as if Bill never existed, and we just buried ourselves in our studies, which, as you know, John, being a physician yourself, it's very easy to do.
Yeah, and it was very haunting, and even though I knew it was from a different era, how even your classmates and, I guess, the faculty just, yeah, went right back into the Krebs cycle, which is iconic for being this kind of very arcane biochemical pathway that medical students still today are forced to memorize, even though it's, you know, not particularly relevant to the day-to-day life of a doctor. And, you know, interestingly, too, even though you had these very formative experiences in psychiatry with both a life-altering event of a roommate's death by suicide and then as a medical student finding some humanity from the faculty member who really handled something very delicately but also didn't make you feel bad for something that you felt inadequate about, you wound up working, I think, first you did some time as an emergency medicine physician and then an internal medicine doctor, but you sort of realized, I think, that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you write about it, how you had seen a lot of trauma and suicides working in those settings, but felt, I think, that you weren't able to sort of treat them or work with them effectively. Is that, does that sort of get at it?
Yeah, what I was able to do, and I think, well, because I had such good supervision, I was able to handle their medical, surgical problems, depending on the means of their suicide attempt. But, of course, so many died under my watch, though, especially back in this time. This was in the 66, 67 era. Doradin was a very commonly prescribed, potentially lethal sleeping medication, and so many of the overdoses were Doradin or barbiturates. The number of patients that we had on peritoneal dialysis, hemodialysis, and it just wasn't successful, and so many of these patients died under my watch. And the same way with the trauma of self-inflicted gunshot wounds or stabbings when I was working as an emergency doc in Detroit, Michigan. And I just came to feel that I wish that I could maybe be of service earlier in this pattern of somebody feeling suicidal before they reach the point of suicidal action. And so that combined with the anecdote that I mentioned with this Dr. Bill Kiley was really what kind of steered me then away from internal medicine, which I was actually really enjoying in so many respects, into psychiatry.
You also write very movingly about a formative childhood experience you had where you found your mother essentially passed out on the floor in the kitchen. Yeah. I think you were 12 years old. And what you came to learn was that she was an alcoholic. And this, you have two older brothers for whom this was really not big news, but you were the middle child, I think, and had two younger siblings to attend to. And this was all covered up as well. And you write about the point where it came time to leave home, and you were very ready to get out of Ontario. I think grew up in a fairly rural area, and you really wanted to come to the U.S. And so you applied to the biggest city public hospitals and wound up in Los Angeles. I thought that was a really interesting. You really wanted to throw yourself in to a different setting and learn about medicine. But what else can you say about that difficulty in your childhood?
Yes, I was deeply affected by it. However, like so many adult children of alcoholics, you grew up with this shameful secret, which is, you know, kind of embarrassing, and there's a lot of anger associated with it as well. And that's why I mentioned when I concluded that chapter that I felt badly at one level, sort of being, you know, so angry and critical of my mother, and that's why I mentioned that come 20 years after that, or 15, when Betty Friedan really wrote the first book on the resurgence of the women's movement and realizing that so many full-time homemakers and mothers were actually depressed, and so many of them had been medicated by their primary care doctors for their nerves and stuff like that, that she really gave up her career in all respects to become, you know, the wife of an attorney and raise five rambunctious children. This sort of thing. So there was that piece to it, John. But what I also found, that I don't know if this is comforting or not, but I realized when I got in medical school that, you know, a certain percentage of us who study medicine have come from homes where one or both parents have a problem with some type of substance. And we've noticed it early, and we've maybe had some sort of pivotal role to play. As you mentioned, I was the middle child, so I was kind of like the sensible one or the determined one and the academic one and stuff like that. So that shaped me in many respects. But this was coupled with this very adventuresome spirit. And that's why I did. I wanted to really go big in many respects and just get, you know, much more exposure in my, in, you know, beyond medical school.
And Michael, I was wondering, the title Becoming a Doctor's Doctor, that's usually a form of very high praise that doctors will say about each other. Say like, oh, so-and-so is a real doc's doc. And usually the implicit meaning is that's the kind of physician I myself would go see if I had a medical problem. And you talk about how you evolved into this way specifically for doctors with mental health challenges or relationship difficulties. This was not something you set out to do, but it just seemed to happen to you. How did that come about?
Well, it was through exposure. And I think that, as I mentioned also in the book, I looked after my first physician patient on Christmas Day back in 1970. Oh my gosh, I learned so much from the pseudonym, Dr. Monroe, and his family, but also to other experiences that I had during my residency of looking after the wife of a doctor on an inpatient unit, then the teenage child of two physicians, actually, in when I was doing child psychiatry. And so I got at least some exposure so that when I finished my training and had a half-time private practice, I've always done half-time private practice, half-time academic work, I at least had a little bit of a leg up, and then it just really evolved after that. I got busier and busier and then decided to completely restrict my practice to only looking after medical students and physicians. So that's how I ended up with so much experience over the, you know, over the decades. But one of the points that I'm trying to make in this memoir is that doctors are human too, that we're really no different, you know, except for some small things than, you know, the rest of humankind. And I wanted to convey that therefore we can become ill, but we can make 100% improvement. And that's why I put so many stories in the book about suffering, really. And this is what can happen to people, and to see the power of human connection and how healing works. So I'm always hoping that after reading my book, readers would understand the immense strain that doctors are under, you know, especially now during the COVID pandemic, but how they can benefit from psychotherapy and other treatments. And as you probably saw the thread too, John, I write extensively about stigma because this is so paralyzing for physicians that they really hesitate to go for help when they need it, and tragically too many of them don't get the help that they really need and deserve, end up getting much sicker and end up, you know, taking their lives. And you'll remember, you know, our interview from 3 years ago, you know, when I talked about that in my book, Why Physicians Die by Suicide. So those are the messages that I'm trying to get out there. And then one final one is that I'm hoping, of course, to attract young people, medical students and early career physicians, to the field of physician health, because there's a real need there. And if they're looking for an area that might appeal to them, that's why I'm hoping that they would take away some, you know, some impressions that, this looks like an interesting thing to be doing.
Yes, and you touched on stigma. I mean, unfortunately, even in this age, 2021, we still see so much stigmatization of people who suffer from mental illness or mental health challenges. But it seems like it's almost doubled in the medical profession. There's the sort of badge of honor or the facade we put up of invulnerability. And you write so movingly about it and have such deep experience in treating people who you understand or have come to understand how hard it has been for them to seek out your help. And one example, you mentioned the pseudonym Dr. Monroe, who you opened the book with. But as a physician, you were a training physician, I think, and you went to sort of present the case, as it were, to your attending physician or senior doctor, and you sort of said, well, I don't want to label him or diagnose this patient because he's a doctor. And what lesson did you get on that very, you know, early experience?
Thank you for asking, John. Yes, because that's really so important. I really consider it kind of physician health 101. You know, when you've got a person opposite you who's really, really ill, as this man was, with a full-blown manic episode, who is at risk of eloping, at risk of harming himself or others, you got to treat them like anybody else. And so that was the point. I had hesitated to do my part of the certification process And so when my attending was going to do his part, he asked if I had done that. That's when I hesitated. And he said, well, would you have certified him if he wasn't efficient? I said, of course. He's really, really sick and high risk. He said, go get the pink papers. And that was really, again, you know, one of those precious teaching moments. And I've used that so much in my teaching, John, because, you know, when we don't treat a sick physician with that same degree of care and caution, you know, there can be a tragic outcome.
Yes, and just for our listeners, when you talk about certification, you're talking about involuntarily committing a patient to psychiatric hospitalization, and that's what those papers are for. Stigma is a theme that does run through the book, and you have a different chapter that early on, I would say in the mid to late 80s, you eagerly volunteered to lead or to be part of a support group for healthcare professionals who were caring for patients with HIV and AIDS because they were suffering from a lot of exposure, from fear, from marginalization. Tell us about that, and maybe are there similarities to that now with physicians on the front lines caring for COVID-19 patients?
Right. Very good question, because I've been now sort of involved at the vanguard of both. Similarities, but obviously made, it's a very different virus, of course, and the contagion is different. But, you know, even at the early weeks here in New York City, when we were the epicenter, even some of our interns and residents who came down with COVID and had to take some time off, they felt stigmatized. And it was so much like at the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, where certainly individuals who were HIV positive really felt that tremendously. And they were. I mean, there was a profound external stigma. It's like anything, though. Once we get to understand the virus better, then a lot of that lifts. But what I was so concerned about at the core of physicians who were on the front lines in Vancouver looking after such a huge number of AIDS patients was that's why I called the Prevent Burnout group, because there were so few of them. I think there were only about 30 physicians. Because there are other doctors who refused to treat patients with AIDS, and some were not even allowed to you know, go into certain hospitals. So we were, you know, kind of the Bellevue or the St. Vincent's Hospital of New York City with St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. That's where they all worked. And so I thought, well, one thing I can do is offer this monthly support group. And we did that for 7 years. And the purpose was for them to come, and they weren't allowed to talk shop, which was very hard for them because you know how doctors will do that. They'll avoid their feelings by just talking about their cases and all of the treatment protocols and things like that. And I really wanted them to dig deep and to really talk about so much of the grief that they were feeling, the anger they were feeling, and, you know, things like that. So that's how I felt I could, you know, I could do something myself in addition to looking after doctors and medical students in my private practice with AIDS.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Michael Myers, a professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate in New York. He's author of a new memoir, Becoming a Doctor's Doctor. And Michael, one of the things that you write about and see so much of is doctors and their relationships, in addition to some of their mental health struggles, just sort of the more mundane, and these are never mundane for those for whom it affects, but these relationship issues. Sometimes it's physicians who marry other physicians, or it's, you know, a one-physician marriage, but you have an expertise in this as well, and you've seen this kind of grow over time. What are some of the issues when doctors marry?
Yeah, that was something that I just kind of evolved into. I would have never predicted that because most psychiatrists don't do couples or don't do marital work. I mean, I hadn't received any training in it. But I felt the need, though. I was seeing so many individual physicians with marital difficulties, and I just felt like just kind of listening and, I don't know, offering support or whatever just didn't seem to cut it. So I went off and I did, you know, a lot of CME in marital relationships and basically got some basic, you know, tools and strategies and things like that. And then, like anything in medicine, you get better at it as it goes on. So that's why I wanted to put that piece in there to illustrate, well, a couple of things. Again, we're like everybody else. We can have strain in our marriages. But I also wanted to point out how you can really get to know a physician, too, even much more deeply when you're also working with her or with him and their spouse in couples work. So it wasn't unusual for me to be seeing them as individuals, also be seeing them together. And there's a particular couple in there, in the book, that I really, wanted to highlight, because they were an older English couple, actually. And I'll never forget their chief complaint when it was the pseudonyms was Dr. Bernice English, when she said to me, "We're here to, it's called mopping up after the affair." And so, our tendency would be to think, oh my gosh, he's had an affair, but it was her. They were in their 60s, very conservative couple. But I was able to pick up very quickly, just in that first visit, that there was something about the specifics leading up to this that led me to think that this woman was actually in a mild hypomanic state of bipolar illness that had been undiagnosed and unrecognized. And her husband actually suspected that, too. He wasn't in psychiatry. He was in another branch of medicine. And so once I was able to do that and then treat her properly, and then so I worked with her individually. The poor woman, she had to get over the shame of what she had done, having this sort of inappropriate affair. These are disguised details with her tennis coach or her golf instructor or something. But her husband was such a prince, and he was as lovely as she was in terms of understanding that something was wrong with her. And so getting her well and then just helping the two of them with this, it really just had such a beautiful ending. And then also then, of course, her adult kids, who didn't really know all these details, fortunately, they were able to see, too, that their mom had actually been quite ill. She'd had a postpartum depression years earlier after one of them. And so just all of that came together nicely so that I was able to meet with the kids and give them what we call psychoeducation on bipolar illness and things like that. And that was really, a good news story, actually, in my sort of couple's work.
Well, I want to pivot here for a second, because the memoir is as much a journey about your personal life as much as it is about your professional life. You've been on a journey, as I guess all of us are, at some, throughout our lives, and you had some profound changes. For example, you awoke to the fact that you might be gay, but in your early 20s, so relatively late, and you identified as bisexual, but came out to your future wife, who was very accepting, and then had a conventional marriage and raised, two children for a number of years until you kind of had this profound change in your life. But in addition, you took on a different religion and you converted to Judaism, which is not something many people do. But how did that come about?
One of the people who reviewed the book said to me, "You've had quite an interesting life." Anyway, yes, the conversion to Judaism had come earlier, of course, as my wife was Jewish. And so when my daughter was coming up for her bat mitzvah, we had belonged to a synagogue, but I hadn't converted. But after taking classes, just for Jewish information, I actually made the decision to convert. So, and that's been wonderful. I'm so glad I did that. And that really also, I think, put us together as a really, closer family in so many respects. With regard to the bisexual piece, I had begun to experiment a little bit with the gay scene just after my internship. It was actually my year of internal medicine. And at that time, at least my exposure to it in Los Angeles, that would be 1968, I wasn't familiar with a sort of happy gay scene. Everything that I involved, the bars were seedy, et cetera, et cetera. Plus the fact I knew no gay doctors. I'd never heard of a gay physician. And so that really concerned me. The other thing, too, was that I knew enough about psychiatry that being gay was a disease. I mean, it was a sexual perversion or deviation or a sociopathic personality. None of this stuff was very pretty. So I was bisexual enough to kind of go back in the closet, so to speak, and slam the door shut. A few months later, I met Joyce, my wife-to-be, told her all of this right on our first date. And away we went, into a relationship, courtship, et cetera, then got married, and we were together for 40 years. So it was really just toward the end, John, as I mentioned in the book, that I had to put this piece in, because this is a memoir, and I had to be authentic. And I think anybody who reads a memoir sort of deserves that honesty. So that's why I then talked about coming out at that. I was 64 at the time when I did. And that's why I put that piece in. But I didn't belabor it, because this is really, it's not really so much my story, but it's sort of my work as a doctor's doctor, but yet, you know, that's, you know, there had to be, you know, bits and pieces of my life too. So,
yeah, yeah, well, I'm for one, I'm really glad you put it in there because it personalizes the memoir so much and
yes,
contextualizes it. And it, indeed, I would agree with the reviewer who said you had such an interesting life because you really have kind of, I don't know, you've lived through so many generations of change in mm-hmm. North America, we'll say, and throughout the profession as well. And one of those ways you highlighted earlier is your work with students. I think students are much more aware, and I'm talking particularly about medical students here,
yes,
about the risks for burnout in the profession. And of course, during the pandemic, we're seeing record numbers of students wanting to go into the medical field or public health, driven by this passion for trying to stem the tide of infectious disease.
Yes.
You have a role there at SUNY Downstate as a student ombudsman. I was wondering if you could share with our listeners what that role entails.
Certainly. Yeah, I've got two major medical student roles. One is being the medical student ombudsman. So my job is to investigate any complaints they have about mistreatment. So anything that occurs in lectures or at the bedside with residents or with faculty or with nursing staff or anything like that where they feel that this is unprofessional. So I investigate those sorts of things, and I've been doing that since the dean appointed me to do that job in 2009. I really enjoy doing that. It's very helpful. I think it's win-win all around because I get to meet the quote-unquote perpetrators who, by and large, are decent people, but they just haven't really kept up with the times, or the way they behave doesn't fit with a diverse culture these days, that sort of thing. So, you know, I do a lot of educating. The other role, though, that I really, really also enjoy is that I'm on the medical student admission committee to our medical school, meaning that not only do I interview applicants, but because I'm the only clinical psychiatrist on that committee, I get to interview all of the ones who have openly shared in their personal statement that they have been diagnosed or treated for something in the past, like perhaps an eating disorder, an anxiety disorder, depression, substance use disorder, or whatever. And so I sort all of that out with them because I really want them to get a fair shake. I have such admiration for them, though, because they made this decision that they had to be transparent. And these are the young people of today, because not everybody does that. We know that there are others who obviously don't. They're petrified. It's so competitive to get into medicine. But, you know, it's so heartwarming because at the end of the day, at the end of the interview, they say, I decided, though, that if a medical school reading my story threw my application in the basket because they think this is just too much for us, I decided I don't want to study medicine there. That's not the right medical school for me. So by doing that, they are really changing how so many of what it's been like for so many of us who are older, who have been so afraid of self-disclosure and things like that. And you, as you also know, we're doing a lot of work to try to get applications to medical licensing changed so that they stop asking outdated questions that are about illness and not about impairment, and really refrain from that because it gets back to external stigma. That's the type of thing that scares doctors from going to get help.
Michael Myers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be here, John.
Michael Myers is a professor of clinical psychiatry at SUNY Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. His new memoir is called Becoming a Doctor's Doctor. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.